Hi friends, welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where every single week we share an idea on the Parsha and an incident from Jewish history with the books and articles that I found the idea and give you some Shabbos reads along with a great idea on the Parsha. Thank you as always to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family. With immense gratitude to Hashem, I am so grateful for their friendship and partnership. I think the most important dialogue in the entire Torah occurs in Parshas Lech Lecha. It's a dialogue that leads up to what is known as called the Bris Bein HaBesarim, the covenant of the parts. And the dialogue is between God and Avraham. And when you take the first look at what they are saying to one another, it's almost incomprehensible. First, God takes Avraham outside. Vayotzi oso hachutza. God takes Avraham outside. Rashi explains, Tzei mi'itzdagninius shal. Go outside of history. Go outside of the normal course of events. Rise above history. And then God reveals himself to Avraham and says as follows. God says, Vayomer elav, Ani Hashem asher hotzei sicha me'or kazdim. I am the God who took you out of Or Kazdim. Laseis lecha es ha'aretz hazos larishta, to give you this land as a possession. So God is promising Avraham the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, and he reveals himself as the God who took Avraham out of Ur Kazdim. Avraham then responds and says, Vayomer Hashem, Bame Eda Ki Ira Shena. How do I know that I'm going to inherit, how I'm going to possess this land that you promised me? And it's a strange response to a promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a promise from God. God promises you a land. He reveals himself to Avraham, and Avraham's response is, Bame Eda. How do I know? Like, is he looking for a down payment? Is he looking for some guarantee? Paperwork, a contract. And in fact, the Gemara in Nedarim on Daf Lamed Beis, I believe, criticizes Avraham for this question. But then it gets even stranger. Then God's response to Avraham's question, to this question of Bame Eda, how do I know that I'm really going to get this land after getting this promise from God? And God responds with the Bris Bein Abasarim, this covenant of the parts, where Avraham brings these korbanos and this kind of, the sun sets, it gets very dark, and a smoking oven and a flaming torch passes between the pieces. There's some who actually say this is alluded to in the very words Bereshis. And if you look at the word Bereshis, it is literally the word Bris with an Aish passing between the two. The entire creation of the world was leading up to this moment of a Bris, and the two parts of the word Bris, Beis Reish and Yud Tuf, in between is the word Aish, meaning fire, fire passing in between. This is the imagery that we see during the Bris Bein HaBesarim. And then God tells him, in response to this question, the Bris Bein HaBesarim, he tells him, Yado teda ki ger yihi azarecha be'eretz lo lahem. Your children are going to be strangers in a land that is not there. They're going to be enslaved and oppressed for arba me'oshana, for 400 years, and only afterwards, v'dor revi'i yashuvu hena. This entire dialogue takes place in the 15th chapter of Sefer Bereshis in Parshas Lech Lecha. Your children are going to be enslaved for 400 years, and the fourth generation is going to come back. Just parenthetically, it's interesting to note that the exile is mentioned in terms of years, an amount of time, and the redemption is mentioned in terms of generations. The exile is arba me'oshana, 400 years. The redemption, however, is dor revi'i, the fourth generation is going to return and get the land that God promises. And Rav Huttner points out in several places, quoting the Vilna Gaon, he has a really remarkable line of why the exile is mentioned in terms of years and the redemption in terms of generation. Rav Huttner quotes in many different places in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in his work Pachad Yitzchak, quoting from the Vilna Gaon. I've looked for ages to find it explicitly in the Vilna Gaon's writing. I think I only found it in the writings of Rav Yitzchak Isaac Chaver in his commentary on Shir HaShirim. I think that's the only place I found it. But any listeners who have another source for this statement from the Vilna Gaon, where the Vilna Gaon writes, HaKilkulim nitlim bizman v'hatikunim nitlim ba'adam. Destruction, difficulty, is bound up with time, and rectification, constructiveness, is bound up with humanity, with people. It's almost like a spiritual law of entropy. Time, HaKilkulim nitlim bizman v'hatikunim nitlim ba'adam, which is why the Vilna Nagon explains that the exile is mentioned in terms of years, while the redemption is mentioned in terms of generations. But that doesn't really help us explain what exactly this dialogue is. God reveals himself to Avraham, says, Ani Hashem, Asher Hoseisicha Me'or Kazdim. I'm the God who took you out of Or Kazdim, and I'm giving you this land. I'm giving you a promise that you are going to have the land of Eretz Yisrael as a possession. And then Avraham responds, Bameh Eda Kir Urshena, how do I know? What's he looking for? A down payment? And then God responds with the fact that his children are going to be in exile in Egypt for 400 years, in Mitzrayim for 400 years, and the fourth generation is going to be redeemed. How exactly does that answer Avraham's question? I'm not sure what Avraham's question is. I certainly don't understand how the response of God's statement in the Bris Bein HaBesharim is an answer. To understand all of this, I want to talk about a sadly still relevant subject from Jewish history that has largely been forgotten, but has still begun to percolate, specifically in certain anti-Zionist circles, and that is the figure of Elmer Berger. Elmer Berger was born in 1908 and died in 1996. He was a Reform rabbi who is one of the most outspoken voices against Zionism. Other anti-Zionists are sometimes content with marching or issuing statements. Elmer Berger tried unsuccessfully to actually influence American foreign policy. By the end of his life, he really became a pariah, even within the anti-Zionist organization that he founded called the American Council for Judaism. His passing at the age of 88 was notable enough to merit a New York Times obituary where he was described as, rightfully so, a foe of Zionism as well as Israel. It's very upsetting, his ideology, especially now, to listen to it, and is certainly repugnant, but many of his ideas do continue to reverberate in certain progressive circles. In some ways, it can be seen as the inverse of the anti-Zionism of Naturei Karta, you know, kind of those maddening Hasidim that we sometimes see protesting anytime somebody gives support to Israel. In some ways, as we will explore, the enduring legacy of Elmer Berger can be even more dangerous. But I don't want to start with the life of Elmer Berger. I actually want to start 13 years before he was born, in 1885. There was a statement that was issued by the Reform movement called the Pittsburgh Platform, where Reform rabbis across the United States declared as follows. I'm quoting directly from the Pittsburgh Platform. We recognize in the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect the approaching of the realization of Israel's great messianic hope for the establishment of truth, justice, and peace among all men. We consider ourselves, and this is the most important part, we consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. They are shifting away from Judaism as being this collective tradition of a people, but rather it is a religious community, a community of religious practice. The rabbi who presided over this is actually very important, was Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, Wise I think it's pronounced, who was actually the most renowned rabbi in the United States at the time. He presided over this conference. And it's just interesting to note, his daughter Miriam married Adolf Ox, who you may know is a pretty famous name because he's published in newspapers all over the world, specifically the New York Times. He is the founder of the New York Times. His father-in-law was Isaac Meir Weiss. And when the Pittsburgh Platform came out, even at the time, and this I learned in the book, Creating American Reform Judaism, The Life and Times of Isaac Meir Weiss by Sefton D. Temkin. It's published by Littman Press. It's a fascinating biography. Some of it, I'm sure for some of our listeners, may find it upsetting, but it is a really important slice of American Jewish history, and these ideas continue to percolate. And even at the time when they came out with this statement, Isaac Meir Weiss faced an immense amount of pushback, a great deal of criticism for his association with the Pittsburgh Platform. There were many people within the Reform movement who demanded that Weiss resign. Some congregations even left the movement altogether. As a whole, the Reform movement has deliberately distanced itself from those statements made in 1885. I'll just quote one Reform rabbi who's extraordinarily outspoken about this. To his credit, his name is Rabbi Amiel Hirsch, and there's a great article that I have linked to in our Substack. Of course, you can subscribe to our Substack where I have all of the links and kind of the write-up of everything we discuss here. That's Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com, I believe. You could Google it, but you could sign up for the weekly Substacks and you get all the articles and the links to everything that I quote over there. But there is a fantastic article by Armin Rosen called The Believer, where he really kind of highlights that very staunch defense of Jewish peoplehood that Amiel Hirsch has been so vocal about, specifically as of late, and credit to him for being so outspoken to his congregation on these very important issues. Coming back to Elmer Berger, Berger was very influenced and almost wanted to turn back the clock to that 1885 Pittsburgh platform. His biography, which you could find online, it's extraordinarily upsetting, his biography. So I don't know that you should read it on Shabbos, but if you want to understand the American roots of anti-Zionism, it is a really important biography to read. The biography is called Rabbi Outcast, Elmer Berger and American Jewish Anti-Zionism. And it's kind of the origin story of anti-Zionism in the United States in many ways. That's become far too common on college campuses, certain progressive circles throughout the United States. Much of his ire, what was Elmer Berger so angry about, was the relationship between American Jewry in Israel, and particularly Israel's law of return. When Ben-Gurion founded the Jewish state, he sent out a letter to kind of formulate the law of return. We'll talk about the details of this letter a different time, but he sent it out to rabbis across the world to formulate who should be entitled to citizenship in the state of Israel. Essentially, the law of return guarantees Israeli citizenship to any Jew wherever they may live. And Berger saw this as undermining the Jewish people's ties to America. He writes pretty bluntly in his memoirs. Guess what his memoirs are called? If you guess correctly, they're called The Memoirs of an Anti-Zionist Jew. The one thing I'll give him credit for is he didn't hide it. This was his raison d'etre. This is everything that he stood for. And he was furious about the law of return. He writes as follows in his memoir: the Knesset adopted the law of return granting anyone recognized by Israeli standards as a Jew the right to immigrate to Israel. This was followed by the law of nationality, which in effect automatically granted immediate Israeli citizenship to any Jew who immigrated under the law of return. The intent and language of the nationality law assumed every Jew possessed the right of a national of Israel and could return to his citizenship whenever he or she so elected. We continued to petition the United States government to take action which would invalidate the application of these laws to Americans. But the bureaucratic pattern remained much the same. The Jewish people, in Elmer's view, were not a people. We're a religion. We're a religious community, a community of practice. We have certain practices that we perpetuate, but we are not a people in the eyes of Elmer Berger. And if that was in fact the case, what claim should a Jew in Brooklyn have, according to Elmer Berger, for the land of Israel? We're not a people anymore. We're a religious community, v'zeh hakol, and that is it. A very dangerous view, which even when people say it, which is an important sometimes thing to emphasize, we of course have a religious tradition that we perpetuate. The Torah tradition stands at the center of our lives, but it's very dangerous to undermine and kind of dial down the notion of Jewish peoplehood, because it can lead to some very, very scary advocacy, which is exactly what Elmer Berger did. He was not content with just being a rabble-rouser. He actually petitioned the U.S. State Department to reject the notion of Jewish peoplehood. In 1963, Berger sent a rambling 43-page letter to Philip Talbot, who was the Assistant Secretary of State, decrying what he felt was the dual loyalties of the American Jewish community that the law of return necessarily required. This is what he wrote in that long letter. By Zionist Israel definition, this Jewish people collectively includes all individuals regarded as Jews, regardless of their legal citizenship or nationality. And the Zionist State of Israel claims that this Jewish people entity has rights in and obligations to the State of Israel. The same Zionist Israel sovereignty further claims that this system of right and obligation is inscribed and recognized in international law. The legal claims of this Zionist Israel state are intended to impose upon some American citizens designated by their religious faith a type of second nationality involving rights in and obligations to the foreign state. So he's re-emphasizing that same point. We are a religious faith. We are not a people. There's no such thing as the Jewish people. We're a religious community. We have religious practices that we perpetuate that people can affiliate with, people can choose to perpetuate, but we are not a people. Some Jew in Brooklyn has no claim and no relationship to the state of Israel. Philip Talbot, thankfully, did not seem that interested in Berger's concerns. Talbot did reply, but declined to meet with Berger. He wrote, "I remain doubtful that a formal meeting of the type you describe would lead to useful results." So they never really met. He did reply to him and basically assured him it's fine to have a state of Israel and that you could have dual citizenship. That's not something that a lot of Americans have, but he was not that worked backed up in the way that Berger was. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency, what's known as the JTA, which is the wire service for breaking Jewish news, reported on the exchange with a May 11th, 1964 headline, State Department Rebuffs Council for Judaism Refuses Request for Meeting. And they ran, the story opens up, the Department of State did not endorse any of the claims and charges made by the American Council for Judaism alleging dual loyalty implications in Zionism. And the Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, Phillips Talbot, refused to meet with heads of the council on this subject. Berger's efforts to reframe Judaism as solely a religion rather than a people, thank God, failed. But his ideas, however failed, should not be overlooked. As we see today, some still marshal the idea that Judaism is exclusively a religion rather than a people that questions the bonds of Jews today and the land of Israel. Berger successfully persuaded, he really worked at this, he successfully persuaded Professor William Mallison Jr. to write an article in George Washington Law Review that you can look up online. It came out, I think, in 1964, affirming his positions on the non-existence of Jewish peoplehood in international law. His ideology, and this is a really, it's a wild article. It's wild, but it's published in JQR, which is a top academic journal. The article is written by Jonathan Mark Gribitz, and the article is entitled The PLO's Rabbi, Palestinian Nationalism and Reform Judaism, which focuses on Elmer Berger's efforts and how his efforts actually were adopted by the Palestinian Liberation Movement in the way that they message the non-connection between Jewish peoplehood and the State of Israel. It is an eye-opening article that is worth reading. Of course, we link to it in our Substack. Few noticed and even fewer remember Elmer Berger. There was one young law student who paid close attention to Berger's efforts to undermine the legal character of Jewish peoplehood. This law student wrote a 47-page treatise on the subject entitled The Jewish People Concept in International Law, rebutting the claims of Berger, Mallison's article in the George Washington Law Review, and the American Council of Judaism. He wrote, "The history of the Jewish people is so permeated by persecution and oppression that the need for extending some measure of protection has been evidenced by many acts of humanitarian intervention and intercession." You have to read it. It's really fantastic. Who was the name of that young law student? It was none other than Abe Foxman, future national director of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. Despite these insidious efforts, the concept, thank God, of Jewish peoplehood remains intact. And that brings us back to the dialogue we began with. "I am the God who took you out of Ur Kasdim," God tells Avraham. "Ani Hashem asher hotseisicha me'Ur Kasdim." Who was that God and what happened at Ur Kasdim? Ur Kasdim, Rashi explains, and you can look up this Rashi in Bereishis, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Ches, that's chapter 11, the 28th verse. Rashi says, Ur Kasdim is where Avraham was thrown into a fiery furnace rather than worship idols. After being thrown into a furnace, this miracle occurs and Avraham is saved from the furnace. And that is exactly what concerned Avraham. Avraham hears, Ani Hashem asher hotseisicha me'Ur Kasdim. I'm the God who saved you from Ur Kasdim. Yes, this was the God who saved him from the furnace after he risked everything for his religious commitment. But what about his children? What about future generations who may not have the same commitment? What about my kids who are not as religiously affiliated and committed as I am? Bame Eda, how will I know, Avram asked, that my descendants will also be a part of this promise? What if they don't possess the same commitment that I exhibited in Ur Kasdim? Will you, God, be a God for them as well? Will they be included in God's promise of the land? And Avraham is concerned that the God of Ur Kasdim was the God only for those religiously committed, those willing to jump into a furnace. But Avram didn't just want a promise for those religiously committed, and this is explained explicitly by the Sforno. He wanted God's promise to be for everyone in his family. He wanted a familial connection to be what connects Jews throughout the world. Avram was asking God that his promise should not be based solely on religious commitment, but rather on a familial connection. He wanted the essence of Judaism to be a family, a people, not just a religious community. And that, God explains, will require a different experience, a different revelation. To transform Judaism into an essential familial connection, it cannot be based on the religious sacrifice of Ur Kasdim, but rather on the familial persecution and experience that we had in Mitzrayim in Egypt. The God of Ur Kasdim was for those ready to sacrifice. The God who redeemed the Jewish people from Mitzrayim was for anyone who was a part of the Jewish family. We know that when we were redeemed from Mitzrayim, it wasn't just the righteous, it wasn't just the holiest. The Jewish people were on the 49th level of impurity, the 49th level of Tumah. We weren't that religiously connected, yet we were able to experience a redemption. And that explains both Avram's question and God's answer of the Bris Bein HaBasarim, the covenant of the part. The revelation of Ur Kasdim was for a religious community. The revelation of the God of the redemption of Egypt was for a family. And if you listen closely to the original language of the Torah, the parallels are clear. In our parsha, God reveals himself, Ani Hashem Asher Otseisicha Me'ur Kasdim. And finally, the revelation that follows the redemption from Egypt that we have at Sinai, at Har Sinai, is Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Otseisicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Me'beis Avadim. It is this revelation that is the response of God to Avram's question, Bame Eda, how do I know? Avram's question and God's response transformed a religion into a people. The recipients of God's promise for the land of Israel was not to a religious community, but to the Jewish people. And this is almost identical to what Rabbi Soloveitchik so movingly writes in his 1978 essay, The Community, where Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, Judaism has stressed the wholeness and unity of Knesset Yisroel, the Jewish community. The latter is not a conglomerate. It is an autonomous entity endowed with a life of its own. We, for instance, lay claim to Eretz Yisroel. God granted the land to us as a gift. To whom did he pledge the land? Neither to an individual nor to a partnership consisting of millions of people. He gave it to the Knesset Yisroel, to the community as an independent unity, as a distinct juridic metaphysical person. He did not promise the land to me, to you, to them, nor did he promise the land to all of us together. Avraham did not receive the land as an individual, but as the father of a future nation. The owner of the promised land is Knesset Yisroel, which is a community persona. However strange such a concept may appear to the empirical sociologist, it is not a strange experience for the halachist and the mystic to whom Knesset Yisroel is a living, loving, and suffering mother. Thank you so much for listening. Just another reminder, you can sign up for our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. And thank you once again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I am so grateful for your friendship and partnership. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading every single Shabbos.